When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Thomas Jefferson, as we all know, was the primary author of the Declaration of Independence. And not only was Jefferson an eloquent and persuasive writer, he was also a botanist, an economist, a lawyer, and an architect. Furthermore, he was a farmer and a politician. Of course, he was also a slaveholder with a complex and confusing understanding of the rights of men. He was also religious, but how religious he was is hard to tell. But let's not forget that he was also a historian and a philosopher. In short, he was a man of many talents and also many contradictions. But for today's episode, I want you to focus just on two of Jefferson's careers, his career as a historian and his career as a philosopher, more specifically as a political philosopher. So as we sit here in 2026, looking back at the Declaration of Independence from 250 years away, we are looking back at Thomas Jefferson from our own historical perspective and our own philosophical perspective. But we can't forget that Jefferson, 250 years ago, was also looking back 50, 100, 250, thousands of years from his historical perspective and from his philosophical perspective. In other words, we today are analyzing, documenting, and deconstructing a document that was written by an expert in history and political philosophy, who was also looking back, analyzing, unpacking, and deconstructing texts that he had read. So, in short, understanding all of the historical and philosophical nuances in Thomas Jefferson's Declaration is a huge undertaking. And here are some questions we might ask. Which aspects of history were most important to Jefferson? Which historical periods was he referencing in the Declaration? How did he see the colonies and the new United States fitting into a longer historical narrative? How did Jefferson understand political philosophy? Which philosophers did he read? Which philosophers did he agree with? And which did he disagree with? And lastly, how can we combine all of this information, all of this philosophy, all of this history, to create a more profound understanding of the Declaration of Independence? As I said, these are heavy questions, and this is an enormous job. But I am fortunate to have someone here with me today to help us answer these questions, Professor Stephen Sarson. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Stephen is professor of American civilization at Jean Moulin University in Lyon, France. He has authored numerous articles and books about American history, including Barack Obama, American Historian. Also, The Tobacco Plantation South in the Early American Atlantic World. And also, British America, 1500 to 1800, Creating Colonies, Imagining an Empire. And most importantly for our talk today, his brand new book titled The Course of Human Events, The Declaration of Independence and the Historical Origins of the United States was just published by the University of Virginia Press, and a link is in the show notes. So, Stephen, as we embark on this intellectual history about the Declaration, why don't we just start with something very simple? Those first words you read, when in the course of human events. Why do you like to start there when you start discussing the Declaration?
Well, we usually think of the Declaration as framed by the self-evident truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident: all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And we usually think of these as the defining words of the Declaration. Some even scholars say these are the first words of the Declaration. But the first words are actually when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to separate from another, etc. Those are the first words. And in a document like this, which is supposed to be short, supposed to be concise, I took the presumption that they would, all words would be important, and that they would frame the rest of the document according to the first paragraph. And so that got me to thinking about the real meanings of that first paragraph and how it would affect the rest. And in particular, I think the most important words are, when in the course of human events and the laws of nature and nature's God that entitle Americans to their separate and equal station among the powers of the earth. And I think the more I thought about it, the more I put those two things together. So we have a course of human events that the Declaration talks about that dates to the creation of those laws of nature and nature's God that goes all the way back to creation itself. And that course of human events is then judged according to the precepts of the laws of nature and nature's God. And once you start to see that in the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, the rest of the Declaration starts to look different. And it starts to look less like abstract philosophy, with these high ideals posed in the first part of the preamble. And then there's this kind of awkwardly attached set of grievances that seem petty by comparison. But actually, if you start to see the rest of the Declaration as framed by the first paragraph, by the course of human events defined by and analyzed according to the laws of nature and God, the rest of the document starts to look like a general history of humankind, and then a particular history of the American colonies and revolution. And then it starts to make a lot more coherent sense, and it starts to look a lot different from how we've looked at it traditionally, at least since it was originally written.
It's almost stunning that Jefferson is like, in just a couple sentences, I'm going to describe the history of humanity.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
When in the course of human events, I'll just like summarize all of human history in these next couple of sentences, and here we go.
Indeed. They did that, didn't they, in the 18th century? I'm going to tell you the universal laws of nature, etc. This was what the Enlightenment was about, trying to boil down these things. That said, the thing is with the Declaration, we've become accustomed to thinking of it as being based on natural rights theory. And then that's the first thing, whereas natural law is a broader thing. But also, we've tended to see it as kind of detached from older traditions of American political writing that go all the way back to the 1660s, but obviously there was a special effusion of them from the 1760s when Parliament started interfering in colonial affairs. And the thing is, you can say when in the course of human events, and it's all very truncated and very brief in the Declaration. But if you read the Declaration in the context of the older political literature, not just the political literature from 1774, but going back further in time, all those pamphlets, all those petitions and declarations before 1774 and before 1776, and you start to see what he means when he says things like the great phrases like the course of human events. And you start to see what he means when he talks about the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. And, you know, these sentences are loaded with meanings that were much more familiar to people then than they are to us now. So it all looks a bit abstract to us now. But at the time, it was people would be thinking, yeah, I know what the circumstances of our immigration and settlement were, and they had a whole history in their minds of that. So you're right. There does seem to be this kind of enormous, these portentous phrases, but really behind them there is something very substantial.
Well, it's portentous, and I guess and it's always hard when we look back from 250 years in the future, but and some historians do say Jefferson very much knew how important this document was in human history. But, like, I mean, I don't know personally if I agree with that, because it's kind of happening as it's happening for him. Mm. It's difficult for us or to realize if Jefferson realized how significant this document would be in North American history, and one could argue in the history of the world.
Mm.
But what I want to start doing now is unpacking some of this language there in that opening sentence. And you've already mentioned this idea of natural rights theory, and we have the laws of nature in that opening sentence. Can you just unpack that for an audience that might not be familiar with what all of that means?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say about that is natural rights, really important, but they're only a part of natural law. And natural law, I mean, what it boils down to for John Locke is something that was created by God, exists in nature. And the principal features of natural law are that no one, whether in a state of nature or in civil society or wherever, no one should harm anyone else in their enjoyment of their life, liberty, and possessions, the unalienable rights. And that applies even in a state of nature. There are laws, the laws of nature and of God, natural law. And those are supposed to continue to exist in more perfect form in a civil society. And people are supposed to obey those natural laws, not to harm others in their life, liberty, and possessions. And governments are supposed to secure those rights. And so I think we need to think of the Declaration as not just resting on natural rights, but on natural law, because there is another, that right to life. If someone takes your life, or attempts to do so, then you have recourse to the ultimate, the first law of nature and God, which is self-protection. And so things then start to get more complicated than they just are in natural rights theory. If you embed that in natural law theory, there are all sorts of ways in which you are entitled to actually alienate someone else from their natural right to life, liberty, or property. The obvious example being in a civil society, if you are a member of a civil society and you commit a crime, you do, in fact, alienate those unalienable rights. It is the job of government, in the name of securing other people's unalienable rights, to execute people, imprison people, fine people. In other words, take away their life, liberty, or their property, as depending on the severity of the crime. It's also necessary to protect a people from external as well as internal enemies. And external enemies, then we start to think about enslaved people, we start to think about Native Americans. And so, you know, if the Declaration is about natural law, then things are a lot more complicated than they initially appear, if we just focus on the business of natural rights.
I was struck as you were talking about the life, liberty, and property. Of course, the Declaration reads life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's always troubled me. Why did Jefferson eliminate what might be the more natural third part of that triumvirate, property, and choose pursuit of happiness instead?
Mm. I think he was probably just going for a broader phrase, for one thing. Happiness, I mean, there are many meanings, and historians have written some very great books about the many different meanings of happiness. But I think when it comes to the Declaration, there is a specific meaning. The word happiness is used a few times. You know, people form government to secure their safety and happiness. And so you see this word through the Declaration. Pursuit of happiness, I think, relates to being able to leave a place, to expatriate yourself, leave your old subjecthood behind and start again, either in a new country under their laws, as previously established, or in a state of nature, as America was perceived to be. And so I think the pursuit of happiness being, and being often portrayed in colonial promotional literature that attempted to persuade people to leave Britain and go to the colonies, you know, and improve those colonies, improve their populations and economies. The idea of happiness there was you'd have political liberty, liberty of religion, and you'd also be able to acquire property. So property is kind of embedded in the idea of the pursuit of happiness and what happiness is. You know, and there's the phrase from Micah was often used in the book of Micah. A man can sit under his fig tree and enjoy the fruits of his labor, his property, in other words, and safely enjoy it because there's no oppressive government or religion. The idea, I think, behind the pursuit of happiness is you can go to America and secure your liberty and your property. So property is inherent in it. And so is the idea of America being somehow separate from Britain. And that's all connected to the idea that Parliament, the British Parliament, has no business in the American colonies. So it signals that. So I think the pursuit of happiness was something very American in this respect. But it also dates back to, Locke. John Locke again talked about this, about how if you're not happy under the political regime you're under, you cannot personally overthrow a government that a people more broadly has consented to, but you can leave, go somewhere else. You have a natural right to do that. And that's what pursuing happiness is, I think.
Interesting. So, and there's sort of an implication of activity there. It's not, he could have said also life, liberty, and happiness, but mm-hmm. he chooses kind of this activation mode, pursuit of happiness. Like, yeah. It's a constantly ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's right. Mm. I mean, people can multiply pursue happiness. They can go to, from Britain, they can leave Britain and go to Virginia. And then they don't like Virginia, they can go somewhere else. So yeah, the pursuit of happiness is, it's one of those eternal laws of nature and God that you can do that. And, there's an interesting letter I should have mentioned, actually, from Jefferson to John Manners in 1817, where he describes what he meant by the pursuit of happiness. He's talking specifically about a Virginia law that during the rewriting of Virginia laws in the late 1770s, he promoted a law on immigration that was specifically based on the natural right of expatriation. And what he wrote to John Manners is, I considered then this law, this of the pursuit of happiness, to be something that is we receive from the King of Kings, not from kings, i.e. from God, not from men, from nature, etc. And, you know, I would challenge anyone to draw on a map the limits of where people can pursue happiness. And so he was, I think, very clear, if you know where to look, about what he meant by the pursuit of happiness in 1776. And indeed, it is an eternal ride. It's ongoing. You can just keep doing it. And for Locke, this was how there are so many governments in the world. People are pursuing happiness, setting up new governments here, there, etc. So, yeah, it's very much an ongoing process.
So as we continue with the Declaration of Independence here, we have that preamble, when in the course of human events. We have the mention of the laws of nature and of nature's God. Then we have the mention of the unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then he says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, right? Mm-hmm. And we've kind of discussed that already. But then the next sentence is the one that I want to focus on now. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends of securing life, liberty, property, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new governments, right? So how do you read that next sentence there? Basically, he's talking about the right of revolution, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The right of revolution inheres again in the laws of nature and nature's God, and it is It's not exactly an unalienable right, because it doesn't belong to individuals, it belongs to a people. And the language is quite specific there when it talks about a people, or one people, and this kind of thing, or the people. So it's a collective right, but it follows from that natural equality and liberty that exists in the state of nature. Because I think what we have here, in those first phrases in the preamble, beginning with, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal. That's about the state of nature. They're created equal. It doesn't say all men are equal. It says all men are created equal. And that refers to natural equality, which for Locke boiled down to two things that he argued against. Robert Filmer, patriarcha, argued that kings by divine right, God granted to Adam absolute ownership of everything and absolute power over everyone. And so for Locke, the idea that all men are created equal rests on absolute individual freedom, there's no government, and a right to access to the earth that everyone has because of the right to life and therefore sustenance. So these are equalities and liberties in a state of nature. That means you can only give these up by consent, because you are entirely free and God has granted you that and nature has implanted that in you. But it follows from government by consent and the fact that these rights are unalienable, that if a government oppresses these rights or fails to protect them, then you must have a right, at least collectively, to overthrow that government. The problem there is you've already submitted yourself to the rule of the people. When you enter into society, you abandon your individual self-sovereignty, and you do come under a government. It's government by consent. It's not imposed by God onto giving power to an absolute monarch at all. But nonetheless, you have committed yourself to obedience to a government that belongs to you, but collectively as a people. And therefore, it's only collectively as a people that you can revolt under certain circumstances. So it all that is linked. And I think it's all also part of a history, because for Locke, and I think for the founders too, all this was real. All this really happened in the past. And when the Declaration goes on to qualify the right to revolution by saying prudence will dictate that people will suffer while evils are sufferable, it says all experience hath shown that people will suffer while evils are sufferable. And so again, it's embedded in history. So we have a state of nature that really existed, a social contract that really happened, and then there was also natural equality and liberty meant people collectively must retain sovereignty, and therefore a right to revolution. And that is historical too, and Locke embedded that in various points in history as well. So one thing follows from another. It's not a set of abstract, unrelated principles. It's a set of historical facts, and that are all grounded in the laws of nature and God.
So yeah, and he says, so again, we shouldn't just be revolting for light and transient causes. Right. You need serious reasons. You need to do this deliberately. But he says, if indeed it is not a light and transient cause, then it is your right, it is your duty. That's an interesting phrase. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such a government. Mm-hmm. Why? That's something I don't understand that maybe you can explain. Why is it a moral imperative? He's saying it is your duty. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a legal duty, a natural right duty, a religious duty, a moral duty. Why is it your duty to revolt? And what type of duty is it?
I think it's a duty to God. Okay, it is your right. I think here the language, and it's in Jefferson's original as well as in the final version, so they thought about this and they left it as it was. You have a natural right as a people to revolt. You also have a duty, because the point at which you revolt, when a long train of abuses and usurpations reveals a direct object to impose absolute tyranny, I mean, I might be mixing the phrases up, but they both, two phrases, it says, words similar to that in the Declaration, in the preamble. When that happens, You not only have the right, but also the duty, because God gave you your liberty and your equality in a state of nature. You have, when we talk about unalienable rights, it's not just that the government can't take them away, though that is true, but it's also the case that you can't give them away. You can give them away by misbehaving afterwards, by committing crimes or endangering the life, liberty, property of others, and then you will be duly punished. But at the point of entering into society, when you create a social contract, you cannot give them away. God gave them to you. And similarly, if a government tries to take them away from you, you have then a duty to God to attempt to preserve them. You may fail, you may be killed, but you must try. And so, and it's part of the rhetoric of the Declaration, but it's also very real. Later on, Jefferson would say that disobedience to tyrants is obedience to God, and Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, who was also on the committee to write the Declaration, would say the same. And this is not just some fancy slogan. This is a theological position that God gave you the rights that you have, the equality that you have, and it is your duty to preserve them.
Now, let me just be a little bit critical of that point.
Okay.
Obviously, one ought to make the leap also 250 years ago, then it would be the slave's duty to revolt against slavery, right?
Right.
So how is Jefferson managing to skirt that implication, I guess, in this line?
Okay. Well, I think, again, we have to put that back into the wider natural law theory of the 17th and 18th centuries. And there's a difference there between 17th and 18th centuries, which I'll come to in a second. I mean, the laws of slavery were at least elaborated by Hugo Grotius in the early 17th century, supposedly based on the eternal laws of nature and God. And under this, if you are in a just war, you may lose, and then to preserve your life, you may give yourself up to slavery, or an individual can by being a noxious creature or something like that. So you can volunteer yourself into slavery. So that can happen, can exist. But there are two problems when it comes to the Declaration of Independence in the 18th century. One, they are following Locke, and for Locke, you are born, everyone is born equal as well as created equal. And that introduces a real problem for slavery, because how do you then have hereditary slavery? Locke's very clear. You can surrender yourself to slavery as an individual, but you cannot surrender your children. They are born free. And also you cannot surrender your property, because it belongs to your children in principle and by the laws of nature and God. So this is a real problem that Jefferson has to deal with. And I think that, and there's another problem that Jefferson himself introduces, and that is the problem of the slave trade. As you know, in his draft declaration, he launches an attack on the slave trade. However, it's actually an attack on the illegal slave trade. It's against the people who never offended him. So this is not a just war. It's a piratical warfare, as he calls it. And so what I think he's doing there, and that's where he starts to deal with this problem that you've rightly identified, and it's very awkward and very difficult, and it doesn't really work. But what he's trying to say is the king obtruded these people on us with his illegal slave trading. And it's an entirely supply side, you know. It's not like we didn't demand these slaves. They were obtruded on us. That's the exact word he uses. You know, and now he's exciting, which is important. He's exciting them to rebel against us and kill us. And this is very much this them and us language. And so what we have is a situation, what Jefferson's trying to argue, in response to the very point you make and that was made by many people at the time, is, oh, you're talking about equality and liberty. Well, how do you deal with the fact of slavery? Samuel Johnson asked that. How is it we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes? Well, what Jefferson is saying is it's the king's fault because he obtruded them on us, and now he's getting them to revolt against us. And what that invokes then is something we talked about a little earlier, the first law of nature and God, of self-preservation. And so you have a right to enslave people and keep them in slavery and even kill them if they are a threat to your life. And you do even have a duty. And later on, you know, Jefferson twice made this famous phrase about, we have the wolf by the ear, we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice in one scale, self-preservation in the other. And so he recognized the problem, but ultimately, what are you going to do? So his next question is, and he asked this question himself, presumably because he's asked it in the notes on the state of Virginia, why not free enslaved people and incorporate them into the state? And that's where race comes in. He then starts to argue that black people are aesthetically inferior, morally inferior, and intellectually inferior. And this long, painful diatribe about the shortcomings, as he saw it, of black people. And I think the key thing there is, there's an interesting phrase that I make a lot of in the book, where he says, I have never encountered a black person who could, they have equal memories, but I've never encountered one who could issue a thought above the level of plain narration. And what that means is, they cannot judge the course of human events according to the laws of nature and God. They are aware that they are treated unfairly and unkindly, so they might rebel. But that rebel will not involve patience, sufferance, obedience to the laws of nature and nature's God. It'll be a nihilistic kind of outburst of anger. And that is highly dangerous. Hence, because of black inferiority, you cannot incorporate them and you have to enslave them until you can expatriate them. So that's how Jefferson deals with it. It's a problem, but basically, what are you going to do? Self-preservation in one hand, justice in the other.
Just a quick follow-up question. And again, sure. I just want your kind of historian's assessment. Just for me, listening to what you said, it sounds like, and sometimes, you see this in many different parts of the world today in political debates, you see thinkers tying themselves in knots trying to justify a position that they feel right. Like they have to justify. So, I look at this as being Jefferson being a politician, no longer a thinker, no longer a philosopher, but trying to summon some idea somewhere that allows him to escape this contradiction that he's put himself in.
I think that's partly right. He had to answer the question because it had been a real political question during the Revolution with all this talk about liberty and equality. But I think on that he had the answer philosophically. And his philosophical answer to this was, for him, laws of nature can sometimes trump natural rights. Natural rights are part of the laws of nature, but so is the right of self-defense, self-protection. And so, he had his answer worked out philosophically speaking. What he gets wrong is, of course, the racism. he was just so profoundly wrong on that, it's quite shocking. But he also got the history wrong, because the king did not really obtrude Africans on America, on the American colonies. There was plenty of demand for it, including from Jefferson's own ancestors. So where he tied himself in knots and got it all wrong and was very political, if you like, was in the history rather than in the natural law. Natural law provided for slavery. International relations...
But not necessarily on a racial basis.
Not necessarily on a racial basis, no, that's correct. Jefferson had to invoke that to get beyond the idea, to deal with the problem that people are born equal. His real problem there is with hereditary slavery, which he admitted. He took on a case in 1771 of a man called Samuel Howell, who was African-American, and his mother had been an indentured servant, and rather than an enslaved person. And therefore, under the Virginia law of maternal inheritance, Howell should have been freed, and Jefferson took his case on. But Jefferson made a bigger point than that during the case, and that is that everyone is born equal under the laws of nature and God. So, he knew this was a problem. So how do you deal with it? Well, one, you regard Africans or African Americans collectively as a race, and then you regard them as inferior. So, you know, and so what are you going to do? What are you going to do with these people? If we let them go, it's war, open war. And that will result, he said, in the extermination of one race or the other, which is, for him, even worse than slavery. So, but, yeah, he got the history wrong. He got the racism wrong. But philosophically, he had it worked out.
Okay, well, let's move on to the long list of grievances now that follow these opening two sections of the Declaration of Independence. And let's do this fairly quickly and just look at basically how this fits the historical and philosophical perspective that you like to view this document through.
First of all, people have their natural rights that God gave them. People consent to government, and then inherent in all of that is a right to revolution. And then the next part of the, I'm going backwards here, but it's important to contextualize those things. So we have this general history of humankind. Then it goes into a particular history of the American colonies, such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which impels them, which constrains them to declare independence, or whatever the exact words are. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. So there's the continuity there. So the first thing I'd say about the grievances is they have to be fitted into this continuity, going back to creation itself, through the general history of humankind, through American history. Intervening in that is a phrase in the conclusions, where they say, we have attended to the British people, we have warned them about the unwarrantable jurisdiction of their legislature, and we have warned them about the circumstance of our immigration settlement here, which is about how they established colonies at their own expense, their own blood and treasure, which, if we want to come back to it, will take us to Native Americans. But this is how we established our freedom, and we came either under royal charters, which forbade parliamentary taxation and other forms of interference in the internal affairs of the colonies, or we came and re-established new societies under a pursuit of happiness, and then made alliances with the king. So, what we have is the establishment of the laws, natural rights, inherent natural rights, then inherited English rights, the right to representation, and then acquired American rights to representation within the colonies. And then every single one of the grievances implicitly and occasionally explicitly references these different kinds of rights. And so the grievances are not just kind of appended onto these great statements about, abstract statements about human rights to be, or natural rights to be implemented in the future. They follow from those. So it's very much a part of a historical narrative that is in the entire Declaration.
I often have looked at the grievances, again, through a political lens. Mm-hmm. I have, basically, Jefferson is realizing I have all these constituencies that need to be pleased, and I need to reference all of their individual separate grievances. The farmer living out in the wilderness, the merchant in Philadelphia, the planter with enslaved people in the Carolinas, you know, I also need to convince maybe some people sitting on the fence. Mm-hmm. So I really look at the list of grievances as a political effort to create a big tent here for the revolution. So how would you respond to that reading?
I would say that's absolutely correct. But I would also say that's not incompatible with grounding them in very real grievances. Things that the king or parliament, either one of them or both of them together, have done that actually do violate the inherent natural rights, that violate English inherited rights, that violate acquired American rights of merchants in Philadelphia, planters in the Carolinas, etc. And indeed, one of the reasons for putting the grievances in these more general terms, as he does, he doesn't say the King and Parliament passed a Stamp Act and then a Sugar Act, then a Stamp Act, then the Townshend Duty. He says he has combined with others and to raise taxes without our consent. But that's a good way of putting it, because it affects everyone and all those constituencies that you mentioned. So, you know, I think what you're saying is true, but that's not incompatible with them being based very much on principles that are historically grounded.
One of the specific proper nouns that isn't used is the one about the Quebec Act. He doesn't mention the Quebec Act, and he doesn't mention, like, the papacy or the Pope,
right?
Because he doesn't want to alienate Catholics. So there's something about these more general terms that it's kind of a vagueness that I would think is intentional. Do you want to make any specific points about just maybe one or two of the grievances that you think are maybe the most significant for you before we move to the final passages in the Declaration?
In the fifth grievance, for example, and I want to consider the fifth and sixth together. In the fifth, he says that the King has dissolved assemblies. Now, this is one of those powers that the King lost in Britain during the, as a consequence, short-term or long-term, of the Glorious Revolution. Not George III, obviously, but the British Crown lost that power to dissolve assemblies at will, only in a ceremonial way, but retain that prerogative in the colonies. So one thing I'd say is the Declaration's grievances are often criticised for attacking the King, but we forget that the King did have these prerogatives in the colonies. You know, the colonists considered their relationship to be with the King, not with Parliament, and they had good reason to do that. The King, through the governors, exercised powers in the colonies that could not be exercised in Britain. So he did have those powers, even as a constitutional monarch.
Here is basically saying the implication for someone reading this would be that we ought to have this right that the King cannot do this,
not
like in Britain, or what is he? What I don't understand the distinction.
It's qualified, because he then goes on to say that the King has done this only because we have opposed with manly firmness his invasions of the rights of the people. In other words, he's not dissolved assemblies in a proper way, so he's done it in a bad way. It's like the first grievance, where he says he has vetoed laws that are wholesome and necessary for the public good. Veto was an accepted power, and the colonists wanted the King to veto parliamentary legislation, even though that's anathema in Britain by now. But for the colonists, it's okay, so long as it's done properly. You can't veto laws that are wholesome and necessary for the public good. And so the same, and the reason I wanted to bring up the fifth grievance there is because it leads into the sixth, because then it says he has then, after dissolving one House of Representatives, he has refused to call another, so that for a great length of time the legislature provided by the laws out of existence. Well, it goes on to say that he has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. So it's the only explicit mention in the grievances of natural rights and natural law, of the sovereignty of the people. And it's one of those, you know, that the people there have a right to protection under government. They've lost that because the King's dissolved the legislature, so the state is inoperative. And so the powers of the state then devolve to the people. So it's a statement about natural rights undergirding the civil right to have legislative law and to have a legislature that's accessible and that sits on a regular basis. So it again, you know, combines natural rights with civil rights, American and British ones, And I think that's very important to remember that. Very important to remember that the grievances are not detached from the preamble of the Declaration. They do follow from that. And the same principles that are enunciated in that preamble do appear, in this case explicitly, but mostly implicitly, in the grievances.
Can you just unpack this phrase, like grammatically and intellectually, for me? So he has refused to allow, to cause others to be elected, mm-hmm. right? So he's dissolved the representative assemblies in Massachusetts and Virginia, and he's refused to allow new elections.
Yes.
And then he says, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, mm-hmm. and there's this weird kind of passivity to this, whereby the legislative powers have returned to the people at large for their exercise. Mm-hmm. Like, how does a legislative power return? Is he just saying naturally?
Yeah.
Like, just like, well, you did this, so you can't annihilate our rights. Therefore, by doing this, you've given us the right to be independent, essentially. Mm-hmm. Am I reading that correctly?
Effectively, yes. Well, to resume government by themselves, yes. And one thing that's not happened is a return to a state of nature without society. There is still a society, a people. So the legislative powers that are incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise. So people can then start to govern them. So if they want to set up a new assembly, they can. But basically, they'll start policing and governing themselves under the laws of nature and nature's God, which are indeed incapable of annihilation. They exist in nature. They were given to people by God. And that includes the power of legislation, of making laws and for yourselves.
Right. And so it's interesting now, just to go back to a bit of concrete history. At around this time, too, people like George Washington and other leaders of various colonies are assuming titles
mm-hmm. yeah.
for themselves. And I think they're not even answering letters from various British officials mm-hmm. if they don't include these titles that they've adopted for themselves. Like, no, you must address me as representative or whatever.
Right.
So they're like, you know, taking kind of sort of almost a bureaucratic or administrative baby step towards independence in this mm-hmm. period by saying, you know, and you don't even talk to me, don't even write me a letter if you can't use this title, this legislative power that I've assumed. Am I reading this all correctly?
That's not in this particular grievance, but it's related to it. In this particular grievance is the first 13 grievances are about everything that happened until the war broke out in April 1775. So this is about things like the closing down of the New York legislature, or that would have happened under the Suspending Act or the New York Restraining Act. And there are a couple of other instances where legislatures had got a bit awkward and they closed them down in Massachusetts during the Stamp Act crisis and after that and so on. So this is earlier, but that point that the legislative powers are incapable of annihilation and return to the people at large is then operative at this moment that you're talking about, beginning in Massachusetts in 1774, when in October the former members of the legislature declare themselves to be a provincial congress that gain their power, derive their power from the people of Massachusetts rather than from the king. And that's the first instance. And then, as you say, you know, other legislatures do similar things in early 76, four more of them. And people start adopting titles, and the Continental Congress itself starts doing. And this is to prevent the state from being inoperative. I mean, people form government for their own safety and happiness. If the government that you have then abdicates that responsibility, you have your unannihilatable, unalienable rights to then exercise the legislative powers as a people. And that's what they're doing. So, yes, it's kind of bureaucratic and it's kind of symbolic, but it also rests on a very deep and very important natural right to have government for your safety and happiness and protection.
And that language is interesting, again. The legislative powers are incapable of annihilation. So the king cannot get rid of this right.
Indeed.
So if he abolishes this legislature, it just passes back to us.
Yeah.
And we choose to take it as it will. And now I really have a firm understanding of that.
It exists in nature.
And it's really great. Yeah, yeah.
And
he can't.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
King George, do what you will, but these legislative powers are naturally ours.
Absolutely.
So either allow us to have a legislative assembly that you accept,
mm-hmm.
or we'll do it ourselves because
it
will happen naturally.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So let's go now to the final passages. We get through all the grievances. And now to end our story, we have to end the Declaration of Independence here. And for me, maybe one or two of the points that I always remember about this is that passage about, nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. This idea that we do share culture, language, blood, and understanding. We are brothers, our British brethren. And then they use the phrase consanguinity later. Again, we share the same bloodlines, the same culture and history, understanding of law, the same rights, etc. And then there's that passage, we have reminded them, our British brethren, of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. And you've mentioned that several times already. Mm. So what strikes you about that passage?
Right. Okay, so first of all, this is the foundations of American liberties as American liberties. In Jefferson's original draft, he expanded on that phrase. I mean, as you indicate there, it ends kind of abruptly. It says, we have reminded them of the circumstance of our immigration and settlement. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. And a new reader might look at that and think, well, what? What are those circumstances? In his first draft, Jefferson did explain them. And he says, we came over here without any help from the British government, and we, at the expense of our own blood and treasure, we created these colonies. And that was accepted orthodoxy. Historians have said, found that peculiar, but if you go back through the literature of the pamphlets, and all the way back to the 1660s, actually, and petitions from the Virginia legislature, this kind of argument was there from the beginning. We are the conquerors of these lands and these peoples. We expended our blood and treasure, and therefore we earn rights to self-government and property. The problem there, and the reason it was eliminated, was because he then said, and we then formed independent governments, effectively states, new countries, and then we made an alliance with the king and the British people. So the empire was formed of and created a legionamity. That's what he calls the empire. And so this is quite radical, right? You're arguing that there was an original American independence, that the American colonies were originally states, totally independent of Great Britain, and then they formed the empire from the outside in, not the other way around. People, and this was first argued by Richard Bland back in 1766, John Dickinson had always argued against it, and arguing, the empire is a proper empire. Parliament doesn't have we have charters that we came over. And those charters are rewards for our efforts, because we did expend our blood and treasure, and they guarantee freedom to tax ourselves and other freedoms within these colonies. But Parliament still has the right to regulate trade and so on. So it was very controversial, more controversial than slavery and other issues that were issues, but not big issues to them at the time. They are to us, but not to them. So this was the big issue, and that's why it had to be cut. But people understood what these circumstances meant, and they meant that we have property rights, and they meant that we have self-governing rights. And so these are the foundations of them. Those property rights come from nature, originally, and the right to life, the right to sustenance. Legislative rights are a British inheritance, but they're instantiated in the colonies through the circumstance of our emigration settlement here. So it's a short phrase, but it's really important. People understood what it meant, and it's really foundational.
But it's sort of packed with controversy, too. So let me just repeat what I think I understood, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong. So we have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here, and then it's left vague. Because there's an internal debate within the colonies about, it's almost a philosophical argument going back to all of this natural law theory that we've been discussing and natural rights, were we independent states when we disembarked off the ships and created our first village in North America? Were we essentially saying, you know, in the voyage, we've returned to the state of nature and we embark on in a new land. And now we say to all the other people on our ship, here we are now in a social contract, the 100 of us that have arrived. Mm-hmm. And other people are saying, no, you came as British subjects underneath the king. That's the controversy there.
And it's essentially, I mean, it has implications for natural law and natural rights. Which ones are you invoking? The rights to contract that is inviolable? Or are you creating an original social contract in the first scenario, the Jeffersonian one? Or is the Dickinsonian one? A contract is still, it represents your natural right to be governed. So the argument is essentially historical. Did we create new societies here, or did we come as British citizens, English citizens under the Crown, under the Crown Charter? So, yeah.
Okay, so as we carry on with the final sentences here, what do you think it's most important that we remember as the Declaration comes to an end?
Okay, so I think there are two actually equally important things. One that is most important at the time, and one that is more important since. And the one at the time is that first paragraph in the conclusions where it says, we have petitioned the king, and our repeated petitions have only been answered by repeated injury. This was really important at the time because it fed into the justifications of revolution. Now, the grievances on their own are not quite enough to have a revolution. The first 13, he's violated our liberty and our pursuit of happiness. The final 5 say he has violated our right to life. But even then, you have to prove intention. In the preamble of the Declaration, it says, evinces a design, or it says, having a direct object. So you have to prove that. That the king is intentionally imposing an absolute tyranny. And the real importance of that first paragraph then is we've petitioned him, so he knows that he is violating our rights to life, liberty, and property and pursuit of happiness. But he's ignored that and he's carried on the same. So he's acted with intent. So that's really important. And it's only then that you can have a revolution. Before that, you're allowed to protest, you're allowed to rebel. But you can only revolt once you've proven intention. And then the second paragraph, the one we were talking about before, about the circumstance of our emigration settlement here. So this is important because it explains what the Declaration excluded. We often think, because we focus on that all men are created equal, that the Declaration is about universal rights. But it's not. If we go back to the first paragraph, it's about one people declaring their independence from another. How do those one people come into existence? First of all, they have left Britain and formed new colonies, so they with legislatures. So they are peoples. I mean, they're still British, yeah, either voluntarily through the Jeffersonian scenario, or they've never ceased to be British through the Dickinsonian scenario. But they're also the people of Virginia, the people of Pennsylvania, etc. So they are different peoples, but they're 13 peoples. But then by the time of the revolution, especially once you get the king attacking or parliament attacking all the colonies, they come together. And those common circumstances of emigration settlement here, in every colony that applies, supposedly, our own blood and treasure without British help. All the colonies did that the same way. So there's a potential there to become one people that then gets fulfilled because of the actions of the king, and they come together in the Continental Congress. The first one creates the Articles of Association. The next one declares independence in the name of one people, until finally we get we the people of the United States. But who are those people? They are the people who come from Northern Europe, who migrated there for liberty. They're obviously not Native Americans. They are the victims of this process of Americans establishing their liberty in America. And they're not African American who came over with the slave trade. So this is where the Declaration implicitly expresses its exclusivities. The fact that it's about one people created by these circumstances of emigration settlement. It's not about all men.
That's a fascinating reading of that. And again, I've read so many of these passages so many times, and I thought I've lingered on all of them. But yeah, that is a critical passage that undermines the all men are created equal sentiment. Or maybe I shouldn't use the word undermines. It carves out, you know, we have the right to create a new society, to become independent, because we removed ourselves from the social contract of Europe, and we create our own now here.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, if you do regard the first part of that declaration, of the preamble, as being historical, then, you know, all men applies to the state of nature. But you then, when you consent to government, you create yourself as a people, distinct from other peoples. So it's all about, really, the Declaration is not about all men, it's all about creations of peoples and then the rights of those peoples, or positioning those peoples as enemies, such as Native Americans and enslaved Africans. And that's what that final grievance, of course, which everyone is kind of embarrassed about, he has...
Excited domestic, savages, yeah.
Yeah, domestic insurrections, merciless Indian savages, so-called. This is not really a betrayal of the principles of the Declaration. It does admit the violation of the natural rights, to some extent, of Africans and Native Americans. But it does so because one people has the ultimate law of nature, and nature's got on its side, of self-protection. So... yeah, we can make war on these people. We can enslave these people because...
yeah, and the last passage of that second-to-last paragraph is, we hold the rest of mankind enemies in war, exactly. In peace friends.
Right.
They're taking the power to kill others, kill people not of their society, or to be friendly, but also they're taking that power as a society to... have a monopoly on violence on outsiders.
Absolutely.
Slaves.
Yes.
Native Americans.
Yeah.
The British Army.
As well as the British, yes.
Loyalists. Right. All of that stuff.
Exactly.
What a wonderful discussion we've had, Stephen. Thank you so much. But before you go, I ask all my guests the same question. What is your one major takeaway for the 250-year anniversary?
Right. So everyone... claims to believe that the Declaration, you know, in the Declaration's ideas about equality, all men are created equal. And some people really do believe that. Many Americans really do. But there are Americans who don't, and who really follow more the principles of the circumstances of our immigration settlement here. And I think it's important, I'm going to make 2 points, I'm sorry, they're related to each other, but... that if you want to criticize a certain political tendency in the United States right now, they're not about equality. They're not about that declaration. They're about the original declaration and its exclusivities. But what those people are also betraying in the declaration, some of them anyway, is that the declaration is ultimately about the law and the rule of law. And people at the time, especially John Adams, said this time and time again, the rule of law is what mattered. Whether that's natural law, constitutional law, common law, legislative law, the rule of law, and that no one is above the law, not even God. These people believe that God was below the law. And that we may not like some of their ideas about the laws of nature and God, especially with regards to slavery. We may not like some of their ideas about constitutional law, but there's that essential principle, the rule of law, not of men. That, I think, is the thing we need right now in our current political climate. It's always good to remember it, but especially now.
Professor Stephen Sarson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.